Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The military drawdown in Vietnam started in mid-1969. By mid-1971, roughly 200 soldiers at Fire Support Base Pace in Vietnam were left to support nearby forces in Cambodia. And on October 9th, when the officer in charge ordered a platoon at Pace to go on attack that night, six men refused. The story behind the refusal was played up in the press as a mutiny, but Bill Shakerty had his doubts that it was that simple. Nothing was simple back then. 40 years later, Bill Shakerty has written a book about the incident. It's called Soldiering On in a Dying War, the true story of the Firebase Pace incidents and the Vietnam drawdown. Bill Shakerty is an adjunct professor in the John Glenn School of Public Affairs at Ohio State University, and before that, senior vice president for business and finance at OSU for 21 years, and before that, state budget director for then-Governor Richard Celeste, and he graduated from OSU in 1968, then enlisted in the Army, and served in the Vietnam War himself. He's with us today to talk about the Fire Support Base Pace incident and the parallels he sees between the military drawdown then and now. Welcome to the show, Bill Shakerty.
Thank you, Ann. Glad to be here.
Question for our listeners. Do you remember the drawdown era of troops from Vietnam? At that time, did you think about the troops who were still stuck there? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Why did you start the book with the October 9th incident?
Well, I think if you read a lot of the histories about Vietnam, that is one of the poster children of the examples of the what was supposedly the decline in morale and the various difficulties that the Army in Vietnam faced. And certainly those difficulties were real. But I thought that was a good place to start. And then from there, I expanded to a broader context. But I thought it was a much more human and personal story to start with those 200 men and what they faced and then to move from there.
When I was looking at pictures of the base and the maps and that kind of thing, it's a lot bigger than I always think of a base to be. And it's probably typical for you, and you think it's very ordinary. But could you describe physically what we're talking about in terms of this base and where it was located?
Sure. Actually, I thought it was a lot smaller than what most people would think of as a base, because it's about 100 yards across. And that's not much bigger than a football field, and you've got 200 people crammed there. And I guess it's all perspective.
Right.
When you're being shot at, you feel it's small no matter where you are. The other characteristic – well, there are two other characteristics of that base. Its major purpose was to be the place for those four big guns to fire into – we were allowed to fire into Cambodia. We weren't allowed to be in Cambodia. But the four big guns were important to support the South Vietnamese who were fighting across the border. The other thing that's important about the base was, in fact, its proximity to the Cambodian border. It was only like 300 yards away. So it was very much – it was kind of out there. I remember I showed a map of this base to a class I was talking to here at OSU, and this guy comes up to me at the end of the class, who's obviously older, and he said, "Boy, you guys were really out there." And I said, "Yeah, we certainly felt that." And he said, "Yeah, I was in Vietnam myself." I said, "Oh, who were you with?" He said, "Well, the CIA." And I said, "I presume you can't tell me what you were doing or you'd have to kill me." And he said, "That's right." But he picked it up right away. And there were no other Americans within 20 miles of that base. So you got a real feeling of isolation. And I was at a similar base, although we weren't attacked as much as that one was. And I remember us saying to ourselves, "Well, it's us and it's them. Us is everybody inside the perimeter wire. Them is everybody else, whether it's South Vietnamese, North Vietnamese, our own commanders." You get very close to people you share that danger with, but you develop kind of an inherent paranoia about everybody else.
Was there actually a fence around it? What did it look like?
Yeah, we called it well, there were two things. We called it a berm, which is a built-up dirt area that was supposed to help defend the base. And then beyond that, there would be barbed wire and other things. The interesting thing about this base is the Army placed an experimental radar. There were like only five of them in Vietnam. It was a ground surveillance radar. And supposedly, it could pick up a person who was crawling along the ground. And so they called that an electronic fence. And then the engineers cleared out all the vegetation and stuff around it. So you tried to do everything you could to make the base easy to defend. But the challenge you had in that area was a lot of the area was wooded. It was a big forest area, and it had been defoliated, it had been bombed, it had been strafed, it had been burned, but the North Vietnamese were just exceptional at using camouflage and digging underground and everything else, so it was hard to see where they were and where the firing was coming from.
My guest is Bill Shakerty. He's author of a new book about the Vietnam War. It's called Soldiering On in a Dying War, the true story of the Firebase Pace incidents and the Vietnam drawdown. Do you remember the Vietnam drawdown? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You were discharged, and about 6 months later, I think it was discharged, or you were home. You were back.
I was home, but I was still on active duty.
Mm-hmm. You read about the case of Firebase Pace. It was widely publicized at the time. Right away, things didn't smell right to you. Why is that?
Well, there were three things. I read about it in the Washington Post, and the headline was U.S. base near Cambodian border evacuated, and it described it as 70 miles northwest of Saigon, which was the same descriptor of the base I was at called Lanyard. And there was a picture in the paper that looked just like one I had taken from the watchtower there. But there were three things about the story that didn't make sense to me. One was the base I was at Lanyard, but this one was called Pace, and I'd never heard of a fire base called Pace, so I don't know where that came from. Mm-hmm. Second thing that struck me was when I was there, it was relatively quiet. We got mortared a couple times. We lost a couple vehicles to road mines, but basically the North Vietnamese were in hiding. By this time, it was clear they were not in hiding, and they were out, and they were raising Cain. The third thing that really jumped out at me, particularly as an artilleryman, because I had been trained, an artilleryman never, 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 ever abandons his guns in the face of the enemy. They had evacuated that base so quickly, they did it by air and they left the guns behind. And I thought, boy, that's odd. So initially, I just was curious as to what had happened since I'd left there. And I really didn't intend to write a book. But then as I started to put bits and pieces together, I saw a lot of the story that had not come out or had been misinterpreted. And that was then eventually led to the impetus for the book.
Yeah, so it inspired you to track down the story or nail it down nearly 40 years later. Mm-hmm. What, it was just something niggling in the back of your head? Was it something that guys talked about that you would talk about when you talked with friends from the Vietnam War? What?
Well, it was a couple things. For a while, I just went on with my life and wanted to get that behind me. But as you get older, you kind of look back and you wonder why did you do certain things and why did certain things come out away. At one point, I asked for copies of the battalion daily logs from that period. They'd been declassified, and you can request them from the National Archives. And the first group I requested were from the infantry, and they didn't tell me much. The infantry guys don't like to write stuff down. And I got the artillery logs, and artillery people are compulsive record keepers. And there was stuff I read in there that jumped out at me. For example, they got an order. This would have been at the end of September, just when things were heating up there, the artillerymen there to be prepared on a contingency basis to spike their guns. That's another term for destroying them. And in the event the enemy was going to overrun the place, I go, wow, that's a pretty serious thing. Then there was a report of enemy tanks spotted 10 miles away in a forest, and there weren't supposed to be any enemy tanks there. Then there was another report of 600 North Vietnamese just south of Firebase Pace. So I'm thinking to myself, boy, there's a lot of stuff going on there. I wonder what the big picture is. And that would be, so I'd find one document, and that would lead to another. And then when I decided to write a book, I knew enough about having been in the Army that these official reports can be helpful, but they aren't always completely accurate. So I wanted to talk to people that were there. The first place I checked was on the web. And in fact, that's where Sergeant Soboski and Specialist Marling had written entries on there. And knowing enough about it, I could tell from what they had written that they had been there and they were telling pretty much what was going on. And that led, and then every time I talked to somebody, they would have a different angle, and it all started to fit like a huge jigsaw puzzle. And when I started, I asked myself five questions that I really was curious about, like, who ordered this patrol and why? Why did they leave the guns behind and those things? And eventually I was able to answer those, and that was then part of what's in the book.
Let's first talk about briefly about what was reported at the time about the refusal to go out on that mission that day.
Right.
And then we can talk later about what you found out, what really happened.
Well, and the key is what was reported by who.
Right.
The initial report came out from, I would call him a freelance writer by the name of Richard Boyle, who was clearly against the war. He was in Vietnam doing a book for Ramparts Press of San Francisco on the decline of morale and discipline in Vietnam at that time. And he had gone to Firebase Pace because he had heard there was some stuff going on there. And as luck would have it, He landed, he arrived there in a helicopter the afternoon that that patrol had been ordered. And so he heard from the GIs there about their concerns about the patrol. He did a tape recording. He picked it up together. He realized he had a story there. So he hopped a South Vietnamese helicopter back the next day, then went to see who would do his story. None of the American wire services thought apparently it was significant, but the French agency Français Presse did. They picked up the story, and it got picked up in the French newspaper Le Monde, and the French loved to embarrass the Americans in Vietnam because they felt the Americans were arrogant and didn't learn from them and so on and so forth.
They didn't succeed.
So it was Le Monde that characterized it as a mutiny and then later Boyle in a book he wrote a year later. That's where the mutiny story started. The interesting thing is the wire services and the, what we now call the mainstream media actually debunked the mutiny story just about the time it came out. And they said, no, there was a combat refusal. What the six GIs were worried about, and I talked to a number of them that were involved, were unmarked booby traps called Claymore mines that the engineers had put out there, and there wasn't a map of where they
US
were.
U.S. engineers had put out there.
U.S. engineers had put out. And, in fact, it was Paul Sabowski who warned them about that, and Paul confirmed that. So that these were veteran soldiers who had a good combat record. They weren't a bunch of troublemakers. They weren't a bunch of dissidents. They weren't a bunch of cowards. They had legitimate concerns about these mines, and they couldn't get an answer to it. So that's what led to the refusal. And that got picked up in the Washington Post and the New York Times and Newsweek. The interesting thing is, though, if you look at some of the histories of the Vietnam War, and I talk about it in my book, there are two different strains. There's one strain that reports it this way. There's another strain that has built up this mutiny into almost mythical proportions because it fits the thesis that the person writing the book has done. And so that's where a lot of the misinformation has come from, people writing after the fact, not from the press that recovered it, that covered the story at the time.
And it also fit into a scenario that was a real problem, yes, which was the morale of the troops.
Right.
Even though it wasn't technically didn't have anything to do with morale per se, there were a lot of problems. Like I said at the outset, yeah, there was a drawdown, mm-hmm, and these are the guys that are stuck at the end.
Absolutely. And that, you know, any great mythology always has enough of a basis in fact to be credible. And in fact, there was a drug problem. There was a racial divisions. There were problems with inexperienced leadership. The troops did feel somewhat abandoned. So all these work together. The point I make in the book, though, is that for those soldiers that were out in close proximity to the enemy, of which the soldiers at Pace were, all that political baloney becomes secondary because survival becomes paramount. And people look out for each other because they have, if they want to survive, they have no choice. And survival is a very strong human instinct. So what you had is soldiers doing what soldiers always do, griping a lot, but they rose to the occasion and did what they needed to do. And I found the pattern that is exhibited there at Pace also occurred at other places that had since been reported as examples of disciplinary breakdowns or whatever.
We're talking about the drawdown of the Vietnam War in 1971. My guest is William Shakerty. He's written a new book on that topic, Soldiering On in a Dying War, the true story of the Firebase Pace incidents and the Vietnam drawdown. If you have any questions or comments for our guest, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page, All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, or you can tweet at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Coming up, we'll hear from a couple of the guys who were there and that Bill Shakerty interviewed for the book. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm General Manager Tom Rylan. Congratulations to the WOSU News Team for being named the best radio news operation in Ohio and for winning recognition for outstanding coverage of Ohio's economy.
Where do you find a job in Wilmington today?
It's hard to. There's no places to find a job.
Ohio unemployment still at nearly 10% and job growth slow at best.
Hear more from our news team on 89.7 NPR News and online at WOSU.org.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Showers off and on throughout the day, tapering off later this afternoon, and warming up to a high of 67 degrees. Currently, it's 59 degrees in downtown Columbus. Clouds for tonight, and a low of 54.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra, kicking off the new season with Lights, Camera, Action, featuring former Tonight Show bandleader Kevin Eubanks, October 26th through the 30th at the Southern Theater. Details at jazzartsgroup.org.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about the Vietnam drawdown and the Firebase Pace incident today on All Sides. Still with us is Bill Shakerty, an adjunct professor in the John Glenn School of Public Affairs. He's written a new book on the Pace incident. It's called Soldiering On in a Dying War. He's going to be doing a book signing on October 26th at 7:30 p.m. at the Barnes & Noble at Lenox. We'll try to post a little note on that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to jot that down. Joining us now is Staff Sergeant Paul Cebulski. He was a section chief of Charlie Battery, 2nd Battalion, 32nd Artillery Regiment at Pace. He stayed in the Army and retired in 1986 as a first sergeant. Since then, he rides motorcycles. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thank you very much.
And just to keep things really simple, we have another Paul joining us, a specialist for Paul Marling. He was a medic with Delta Company, 1st Battalion, 12th Cavalry Unit at Firebase Pace. After Vietnam, he earned degrees in nursing and healthcare administration and retired in 2005. You returned to Vietnam in 2006. Welcome to the show, Paul Marling.
Good day, Ann.
Paul Cebulski.
Yes.
You've been at Pace a while before the enemy offensive began on September 26. Can you tell us what it was like when the shooting started, and were you surprised?
Well, I had just transferred to Pace from another battalion, 2nd of the 12th, that had stood down part of the downturn in forces in Vietnam, and I'd got there approximately in last of July of 71, and Pace was a really show-stopping style firebase. It was an excellent facility. And then I believe the shooting started sometime around September 25th, and things got really hectic after that. We were in constant shelling situations. It wasn't a continuous type of thing. It was sporadic, but we were so close to the Vietnamese army and the North Vietnamese and the Cambodian border that every time we started the engine on the guns to move them, they could hear us, and then they would immediately retaliate by starting mortars or RPGs, rockets, whatever they had, start throwing them in our direction. And these weapons did not have any type of protection for the crews. It's an outside-style weapon where it's self-propelled, but there was no turret or anything like you'd think, like a tank.
Mm-hmm.
And so, consequently, we were exposed to the hostile fire continually over and over again, day after day.
Or the threat of it, correct. Right. What was it like to get up on those guns, knowing that you were the target?
Well, sort of scary. I come to find out by talking to Bill Shirty that, you know, a lot of information being just a little cog in a big wheel, you don't really know exactly what's going on. But we had 175-millimeter gun. This was a long-range artillery piece. It shot 20 and a half miles. And what we were doing was supporting a Vietnamese operation in Cambodia, and we were the long-range artillery that could reach their positions. The North Vietnamese wanted to eliminate the 2175s in particular because we were a thorn in their side. And they did so successfully on the first night by hitting gun 2 with 3 direct rounds off a mortar, and it messed that gun up. It was non-repairable, and you couldn't shoot it. So that left me hanging, being the only, quote, long-range gun we had. The 8-inches shoot about 10 and a half miles. And the key to what we were doing, I told my troops, because I had my whole section, we were all draftees. I was the only RA guy in the whole thing, and I was only 22 years old, and I was an E6. So I said, here's the deal. I had an excellent track driver, a guy named Johnson. I loved him to death. And me and Johnson would go out and start the track and shift it to an azimuth we were going to fire and drop the spade, because the thing had a spade like a bulldozer on it, and get it sort of position where we knew we were going to lay the weapon. And once we did that, we'd yell, and the rest of them would come out from the bunkers, because I didn't want to expose them to indirect fire any more than I had to, and sort of keep the possibility of having casualties down to the minimum. So every day it was a trip. You know, it was an exciting thing because you never knew what was coming, where it was coming from, and when you fire these particular weapons, you had to leave the engine running, because it had a power takeoff shaft that operated the hydraulic system, so you could not hear something getting fired at you. It would just come in and land, and there it was. And so, you know, you felt rather like a duck in a shooting gallery, you know, that kind of thing.
Bill Shakurdy, how long did that siege last? 27 days. Paul Marling, how did you learn you were going to Pace, and what went through your head when you heard about it?
We had just been out in the field. We had been sent out from a fire base north of Benoit called Fire Base Timbuktu about on September 25th, I believe. When we went out on our mission, I heard one of the other platoons was going to a place called Fire Base Pace, and that it had become under siege. That happened to be my very first mission in Vietnam. I had just arrived in Vietnam about 10, 12 days before that. So we were told we were lucky that we were going where we were going and not to Pace. Being out, when we were out in our mission, we had found a large supply of flour that the North Vietnamese had hidden in the jungle, and we had proceeded to try to evacuate that out when we were informed that the group that was at Pace was being pulled out and we were being pulled in. And
after you landed, Bill Shakurdy writes about it in the book, a Cobra helicopter was shot down nearby. I mean, this was right after you landed.
Oh, yeah, it was probably shot down as we were flying in.
Okay.
The same lieutenant that had come out to tell us what was going to happen as we landed in, as far as instruction that we were going in, the Hueys were not going to touch down. They were going to hover as they could right by the front gate, and we were just to jump out and run like hell through the front gate and take a left, and there would be a bunker right in there. As the first group of us arrived on the base, which was, I estimate, probably about 12 infantrymen from the first cap, this Lieutenant Lee came back into the bunker and basically said, boys, a Cobra just was shot down into the wood line. And he was protecting us. Now we have to go out and protect him. So, and he said, basically, are you with me? And we dropped our rucks, grabbed our weapons. I took my aid bag, and we proceeded back out the gate that we had just run in while the rest of my company was being inserted into Pace.
When you went out to rescue those two pilots, some of the people literally who had refused to go on patrol the next day, even though that was less dangerous than chasing down the crashed helicopter, they were some of the people that went out with you that day.
Oh, sure. And one of the things that when I read Bill's book, after reading one chapter, I sent him an email, and I said, Bill, the Claymore mines that those guys originally didn't go out on their mission because they didn't have the map, and then went out the next day and removed them. They sound like they were in the same location that we went out to get the Cobra guy. And he said, yes, they were. So if it were not for them taking them out, we may have walked right into them.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the drawdown of the Vietnam War. My guest in the studio, William Shakurdy. He's the author of Soldiering On in a Dying War, the true story of the Firebase Pace incidents and the Vietnam drawdown. Also with us by phone, Paul Marling, specialist for at the time, was a medic in Vietnam at the time, and also First Sergeant Paul Cebalski, who's a staff sergeant in Vietnam. If you have a question or comment for them, do you remember the drawdown era? Give us a call and tell us what you thought about it. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Paul Cebalski, how did you feel when the order came down to evacuate the base and leave your guns behind? I think you or Bill Shakurdy said that was very rare.
Yes, it was. This was my second tour in Vietnam, and I've been in the Army in 6 years, and I'd never heard anything like that. Even though I knew in cases during, like, the Second World War and maybe Korea or places like that, that they did sabotage the weapons and because of an overrunning situation with the enemy, you don't want a weapon like that to fall operational into the enemy's hands. Of course, they'll just turn them around and use them on you. It felt bad about leaving your weapon, you know, sort of like leaving your car in some place you don't know where it's going to be at or something.
Yeah.
You had this little aftermath thing, but we felt sort of bad because it just occurred two or three times that they were going to, quote, get us out of there, and then, no, we're not going to get out of there, and it yo-yoed back and forth, you know, several times. I think Bill alluded to it in his book, and there for a while was a little confusing. Really, I think after we got sort of used to our situation, even though we didn't like it all that well.
Used to not know what was going to happen the next day.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. We got used to the situation. Everybody sort of buckled down and stayed with the program. You know, the guys I had soldiering with me, I'd soldier anywhere with.
You'd been with the Army, you said you'd already been in 6 years. Was it different at that point than it had been previously for you?
Well, I don't see it was a heck of a lot different. You know, they keep alluding to all this drug use and so forth. I didn't, in second to 12th, I had some guys who were on heroin. And when their heroin supply got cut off, they started this, what they call amnesty program. You could turn yourself in and go in and get cleaned up. So we got rid of those folks. We had the marijuana smokers. And we had standing rules in my section, and this is what I told these guys when I got there. Because, you know, first day I'm there, I'm smelling marijuana smoke, and I go in there and I tell them, "Here's the deal, fellas." I says, "If you smoke that stuff," I said, "I don't condone it, but I said I'm not going to tell you you can't do it, but I'm going to tell you this: if you get so messed up that you cannot go out there and function on that weapon, I'll have you court-martialed in 24 hours. You figure out which one you want to do first." And everybody knew what the rules were, and they, and for this entire 20-some-odd days that we were under this siege, it was pretty much them guys was running, you know, helter-skelter. We were more interested in getting out there in one piece than we were about trying to get high, so to speak. And personally, myself, I don't use this stuff, never have. Marijuana smoke makes me ill. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that was just one of those things. I knew it was there, and it always amazed me where they got it from. I couldn't figure it out because nobody ever went outside the gate. So I don't know if it was being brought in or how they did it. But I guess when you're doing dope, you can figure out some matter of doing it. But that was standing rules, and everybody knew exactly where I was coming from on day one. Now, in 67, 68, when I was there, the marijuana was around, and people did it and all that kind of stuff. But the hard drugs, the heroin, was really rare. Now, like Bill said, the units back in the rear, in Long Bend and Benoit, the Rimps, as we called them, those were the guys that more or less got more in trouble because they were sitting around bored. They didn't have a lot to do. The line units, like the infantry units and the artillery units and the armor units that were out in the sticks, they had to take care of each other a little bit better. And so consequently, somebody walking around stoned all the time was not going to go over well with very many of them because they couldn't hold up their end of the bargain, so to speak, or do their share of the work. So because, like, these weapons that we had at Pace were very maintenance intense, If you fired them all night, then you'd work on them for 4 hours the next day to get them ready to fire the next day. That's just the way it worked every day of the week. So we couldn't stand to have somebody who couldn't hold up their end of the bargain.
And was it difficult to keep them in line in that way? Bill Shakurdy mentioned in the book a couple different times in a couple different ways that taking care of each other was the best reason to do a good job.
That's exactly right. It's just like a family. You just sort of look like a family there, even though there's 10 people from 10 different parts of the country and from different backgrounds and different educational levels. You all got together. When I had that RPG ricocheted off my tube and went through the building next door, I'd had a little problem trying to get them convinced to put this RPG wire up, as we call it, which is nothing but storm fence. Until I said, okay, I want you all to come over and take a look at this. And they went over and took a look at inside the building. I said, get the RPG wire up now. I said, this could be you next. I'll tell you what, 25 minutes, they scrounged up enough wire to have it rolled all the way across the front of that building and give them a sense of protection that they hadn't had before, because once they realized what one of these things might do to them, it woke them up real quick.
According to the epilogue in the book, Paul Cebulski, you stayed in the Army, eventually became a first sergeant. How did it change over time from the Vietnam War on?
It was a real turmoil. Only for a couple years, though. When I left Vietnam, I went to Fort Sill, Oklahoma in 72, and it wasn't too bad then. 73, when we stopped the draft and we went to the all-volunteer Army thing, I became a drill sergeant in that time at Fort Knox, Kentucky. And we could see this transition thing. And the Army's, I don't know, sort of a social adventure sometimes. They try to experiment with it, doing some of these things that really shouldn't be done. But anyway, but what we had was we were getting away from the old military regiment type of thing that we were used to in the 60s, which was a drawback all the way back to probably day one in the Army, to a more liberal viewpoint of some of these things, and it changed around. And as I saw, the first year of the all-volunteer Army was not all that great. We had a lot of good kids come in. We had a lot of people that were just looking for a job because they had the oil embargo thing going on, and they had no more interest in being the Army than a man in the moon. But as we progressed into 74, 75, the quality of troops went up significantly. Not to say that the draftees weren't great soldiers. They were. But as the Army improved each year, it was a quality unit. And by the time I retired, I'd say it was as good an Army as I can remember being in 20 years, without a doubt.
Paul Cebulski, thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
I thank you for having me on, and appreciate it. And tell Bill hi for me, and hope everybody takes a gander at this book, because it's a very intense and very detailed and well written book.
All right. Well, thanks again, First Sergeant Paul Cebulski.
Thank you, ma'am.
He was a staff sergeant and a section chief of Charlie Battery, 2nd Battalion, 32nd Artillery Regiment at Pace. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation with William Shakurdy and also Paul Marling. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Air Force Lieutenant Josh Seyfried started a secret Facebook group for gay and lesbian soldiers called OutServe. Now Lieutenant Seyfried is out, and so is his boyfriend, Air Force pilot Lieutenant Carl Johnson, who has been blogging for Time magazine as Officer X. Seyfried and Johnson join us on the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And time is running out on your opportunity to win an iPad 2 and support our station. Our fall membership drive begins tomorrow, and by making your pledge early, you will be automatically entered to win an iPad 2. Visit WOSU.org now, make your pledge, and get registered. No pledge is necessary, but your support will continue to pay for the programs you enjoy. The deadline is tomorrow. Entries are only accepted at WOSU.org.
Support for 89.7 comes from Marburn Academy, a forward-thinking school for ADHD and dyslexic students hosting a community parent seminar, Understanding the Problems of ADHD Children, Tuesday, October 18th at 7 p.m. More at marburnacademy.org.
Rain in the forecast for today and a high of 67 degrees. Cloudy skies for tonight and a low of 54. Clouds for Thursday, a high of 71. More rain Thursday night, a low of 52. And showers are likely on Friday as well, a high of 64. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about the Vietnam drawdown, or the drawdown from Vietnam, the Vietnam War, and the Firebase Pace incident today on All Sides. Still with us is Bill Shakirti. He's an adjunct professor in the John Glenn School of Public Affairs at OSU. He's written a new book on the Pace incident. It's called Soldiering On in a Dying War, The True Story of the Firebase Pace Incidents and the Vietnam Drawdown. Bill, once again, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Ann.
Also joining us is Specialist 4 Paul Manning. He's retired. He was a medic with Delta Company, 1st Battalion, 12th Cavalry Unit at Firebase Pace. After Vietnam, he returned to civilian life, and he returned to Vietnam in 2006 for a visit. Once again, Paul Marling, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for asking me.
Bill's book says that you kept in contact with families of the 4 helicopter crew members who were killed when their Huey was shot down on September 29th. What can you tell us about those relationships?
When I first came back, I really did not know the names of the helicopter crew. And through time, that became important for me to try to learn their names. Because I'd go down to the wall in Washington, and I'd know that they were up there, but I didn't know where. So through the marvelous internet, I was able to come up with the names of the 4 people. And I had posted something on the internet about I respected them for what they did. They basically, when the base was first coming under fire on a resupply mission, that the base desperately needed to get. They lowered their gunship in the line of fire to protect the resupply ship, which I think they sacrificed themselves for the need of the greater. So when I learned the names, I put something out, and within a very short time, I was contacted by first the sister of one of the men, one of the pilots, their brother was the crew chief, and then the brother was the brother of one of the pilots of the helicopter. And I have kept in touch with them from time to time through the last 10 years or so.
You've been back to Vietnam as well, and
yes,
actually
I visited
Firebase Pace, or the site of it.
Yes, I did. I went back in 2006 with my wife and a friend that I had become involved with, gotten to know that helped people to go back to Vietnam. And about the only combat-related place that I went on that trip was Firebase Pace.
It was an empty field, right?
Right now, right. There's just like a plowed field in with just short brush grass. The trees are starting to grow back up, but right now there's nothing there. Shortly before I had gotten there, right at the border crossing, they had just made that a new international border crossing, so you could cross from Vietnam into Cambodia.
What was it like when you got there and just looked across that empty field? What came back to you?
Uh, Well, basically, all.
Everything
Pace,
at once,
Pace,
huh?
Yeah, yeah. Pace was a place that if you served there for any amount of time, it was a place you will remember forever. You know, as the other Paul spoke, it was a very nasty place, but and then what you got kind of got used to it. You know, you were shelled several times a day, for day in and day out, but you just got up and went the next day. When I got there, it was basically all of a sudden you're driving through the road because after I flew in there on top of the treetop as we're driving in by van. The guy that was with us kept on asking me, does anything look familiar? And I said, no, because, you know, I didn't come by road. I came by helicopter.
And you left by helicopter.
Correct. So I was wondering whether we were ever going to really find the spot. Because we came to a place that there were just row after row of rubber plantation trees. And then all of a sudden, you broke through the trees, and the landscape that Paul Sobalski described as far as the trees all being cut, it being defoliated, a quarter of a mile swath, like just taken out of the jungle. And as soon as I saw that, I knew this was the place. And as we got closer and get out of the van, I can remember stepping out of the van and saying to my wife, well, that's where the fire base was, and that's where the Cobra went down, and that's where the other helicopter crashed.
I interviewed some documentary filmmakers about a year ago about a very remote place in Afghanistan where there was a unit or a bunch of soldiers, kind of on the very outer rim of in one of the most remote areas of where the fighting was, which made it one of the most dangerous. And a lot of the way you describe what you went through and your feelings about the base echo what they learned from making their film. I was wondering, do you feel any different now about your experience now than you did then?
Now, mm-hmm. Bill's book, I think, helped explain, you know, because there were a lot, as we say, we were very low on the food chain. You know, a spec four is not consulted as far as the rules of engagement and things like that. So I was not aware that there were no other GIs within 20 miles. I was just on the base wondering, well, with all of these NVAs here and all of the siege going on, where's the reinforcements? So Bill's book, his delving into the reasons and the whys and what was going on that we all boots on the ground didn't know about helps explain a little bit of it.
Bill, was that maybe one of the goals, or is that something that came about that you hadn't exactly expected, is filling in some of the blanks for these guys that were so isolated?
Yeah, a little bit of both. I mean, having been at a fire base myself, it wasn't as intense as what happened at Pace. You always wondered what the bigger picture was. And when I went back and saw records from my unit, there was a bunch of stuff they didn't tell us about. So part of it started with that. But it also then surprised me how much was going on around that base, the different layers of activity, the technology that they were using to protect the base, what the South Vietnamese were doing, what the North Vietnamese were trying to do. All that came out in these records and the interviews. And it, as I mentioned earlier, it's like putting together a giant jigsaw puzzle. And all of a sudden, it starts to take shape and form. And it helped me because when I came back, I wasn't sure about what we'd accomplished there. And what it helped me understand is at least what it was my unit was doing, and that the real thing we were doing was looking out for each other, and that all this other stuff was secondary. And it kind of helped me put it in some sort of perspective.
Paul Marling, were the folks that you served with at Pace necessarily anti-war as a rule, or was it it wasn't about that? What was the atmosphere there?
I really don't think it was about being anti-war. It was more, you know, as Bill said, looking out for each other, And then at times, you just did not blindly go along with a request or an order that, particularly if it didn't make sense. So I think folks being in that situation, you wanted somebody to at least explain to you why you were going to risk your life, not just, okay, yes, sir, I'll go do it.
And risk your life, of course, after the war is basically supposed to be over.
Correct. Well, at that time, most of the folks back here were being told there were no active combat troops. When I was in a frontline infantry unit who spent more time out in the field than I did on even a remote base.
You were one of the last boots on the ground. Do you have anything you'd like to say to the soldiers and other military enlisted people who might be among the last troops on the ground in Iraq or Afghanistan eventually?
Well, even you're saying, you know, I was one of the, you know, this, we're talking 1971. Mm-hmm. There was still months and months after my time there that there were still folks there.
Right.
Even after I left Vietnam, you had the whole, what they referred to as the Easter Offensive in 1972. So there was still a lot of combat, a lot of fighting going on even after this. And that's what folks have to remember if, you know, like what's going on now with Afghanistan and Iraq, that we still do have troops there. I just recently was in contact with, matter of fact, the sister of one of the helicopter crew. Her daughter had a friend who was serving in Iraq now. And because of the troop pull downs, they're getting less and less like PX type supplies, mm-hmm. and things like that. So it's back to, you know, they really could use the old care package from home. Because they're just, you know, people forget about them now.
What is it like the lunchroom at school? They start running through all the food and you start eating stale rolls by the end. Is that what you're talking about?
No. It's more you get soap, toothpaste, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Bill Shakurdy, what do you think are the lessons from the book for the future? You make a point in the book that I thought was interesting. This is not the first time. There's always those last boots on the ground after a withdrawal, after the end of a war. There was in World War II, you said, in the Korean War there were, and going forward, what can we learn from this?
Well, a couple things. One other point I make out is be careful of people who declare lessons learned, because sometimes there's a political agenda behind it. So every war is a little different. But there's some themes that are very common. One is when you're the last folks on the ground, things get a little squirrelier. It's always when you're dealing with human beings in a high-stress situation, you get all kinds of behavior, both good and bad. It becomes even more intense than with the last folks on the ground. The other lesson I would say that's important as we look forward to Iraq and Afghanistan that we can learn from Vietnam, and I would say this more to the political leaders and the rest of the country, is those soldiers that are still there are there in our name. Don't forget the troops. And to the political leaders, it's important to take credit for winding down the war, but don't do it in such a way that minimizes the sacrifice of the people that are still there. And I didn't intend this to happen, but as I was writing the book, I started looking at what the Nixon administration was saying about what the troops were doing and what the troops were actually doing. And I had a similar experience to Paul Marling when I was on my base, because they declared that Americans were out of ground combat in War Zone 3. And we said to ourselves, well, wait a minute, we're American, we're on the ground, and we're in War Zone 3, and somebody's shooting at us. How can that not be the case? So I would hope that whichever administration or administrations are overseeing the withdrawal from Iraq and Afghanistan, they're remembering the troops, but they're also being honest with the public about what those troops are going through. And I think that's extremely important, because you're asking those men and women to stick their necks out and to sacrifice everything, if necessary, for their country. At a minimum, their country should recognize the nature of that sacrifice.
The media played a very big role, one way or the other, in the Firebase Pace incident and the reporting of it, obviously. What anything about that that you'd like to reflect on in terms of the differences in how the Afghanistan war and the war in Iraq have been covered?
That's an interesting question. And as you know from having read the book, I give the media, with the exception of the Mutiny Report, really pretty high marks for trying to get the truth out. What is interesting is in Iraq and Afghanistan, you have a much more not the dominance of the three networks and the three news weeklies. But it seems like people are still going out with the troops and giving good reports. And I think the military has become a little more comfortable with not censoring what comes back. So I think when a democracy like this goes to war, it's important that the media have an opportunity to be with the troops to report back to the people at home what their troops are going through, both for good and bad. And I think that's extremely important to a free society being able to remain free. And that sometimes when you get in a war situation, the temptation is to shut everything down and censor everything. I think that would be a mistake.
Paul Marling, what's your impression of the media coverage in the wars right now and how that might contrast or compare with what happened in Vietnam?
During my time, you know, as I said there, I right after Pace, I can remember being on a mission where one of the other infantrymen and one of the other platoons got injured and went back to one of the evac hospitals, and a reporter went to interview him, and basically saying, you know, what does it feel like being one of the last men to be wounded in Vietnam? Again, you have to, this is back in probably at that time, November of 1971. Mm-hmm. And they seem to have bought into there were no more troops there. No more active troops. Now, at least you get the reports, although the news of today doesn't have the war every night is right. The main mm-hmm. lead, which they did back in the, I think, the 60s and the 70s. The, you know, the Vietnam was in everyone's face day in and day out.
Oh, by the late 60s, for sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Where this time they give reports and they seem to allow some of the military to be truthful, saying you know about their situation, mm-hmm. about being out in the middle of you know the hills of Afghanistan, where they're really on their own. There's no support else out for them, so that they have to be looking out for one another.
Well, Paul Marling, I want to thank you so much, not only for your service, but for also joining us today.
Okay, and thank you for asking me.
Paul Marling was a medic and a specialist four with Delta Company, 1st Battalion, 12th Cavalry Unit at Firebase Pace. That's the subject of a new book by my other guest, Bill Shakerty. Bill, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
The name of Bill's book, it's called Soldiering On in a Dying War, The True Story of the Firebase Pace Incidents and the Vietnam Drawdown. Bill is going to do a book signing on October 26th at 7:30 p.m. at the Barnes & Noble at Lenox. You can learn more about that at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org 89.7. NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.